May it please the court, counsel. My name is Devi Axelson. I represent the appellant, Nadeem Malik. The simplest way for this court to resolve this case is by addressing the statute of limitations argument presented in issue number one. The state failed to present evidence that Mr. Malik was ineligible to receive benefits during January of 2015, and they waited over 3 years after that month to January of 2018 to charge him and allow the statute of limitations period to lapse. It did so because the state did not have any information introduced at trial that Mr. Malik was receiving self-employment net income from Orient International during January of 2015, or that he was receiving any type of net income from stock trading done in his Scott Trade account in January of 2015. And the state's main witness, who attempted to try to piece together this hodgepodge of bank accounts and trading information, Ms. Lang, admitted on multiple times during the trial that she wasn't clear how much income Mr. Malik had at all during the entire charging period.
She was an investigator more than a person who makes determinations of what a person is making net income.
Correct. And the state didn't present a self-employment.
That's the word I was looking for.
Yes, they didn't present a witness to testify about what they believed Mr. Malik's self-employment income was at any period of time. They didn't present an expert also to go through his Scott trade accounts and determine what was net income versus what were just assets, based on the trading that was done in that account.
Do you think there's some level of cash flow that doesn't require a self-employment expert to indicate that you're getting a significant amount of self-employment income?
I think that in order to prove your case, and based on this court's opinion in Mora, that the state has to show net income. So just establishing a large amount of gross income, whether it's millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars, without establishing what the cost of purchasing those items were or the expenses resulting or revolving around that business, then the state isn't following through with its beyond the reasonable doubt requirement to prove net income. And as you get to our second issue, that revolves around the sufficiency of the evidence. But I think it's really clear that even if there was a number of a large amount of gross income that was maybe coming in early on with this Orient International, a lot of that had kind of dwindled down to the point where at the end of 2014, there just isn't as much money coming in. And by the time we get to 2015, the state hasn't made any argument that in January of that year that there was money coming in to Orient International, or even if there was money coming in, that would qualify as net income in this case. I think the additional problem is for the state here is that their experts that did testify, or the people who worked at Hennepin County testified, is that in order to determine self-employment income and to determine whether somebody is ineligible, you have to determine that on a month-to-month basis. And here the state is attempting to shoehorn what they thought Mr. Malik did gain in gross income over the entire period and try to cut that into 29 perfect pieces over that entire time period. But clearly no accountant in the world would determine somebody's income over such a large period of time. It would most likely be determined on a year-by-year basis or here on a month-to-month basis. Additionally, the state wants to rely on information that came in after January 2015, and I think it's pretty clear here that the county found that Mr. Malik was eligible after, I believe, February of 2015. So that, in order to commit this crime, you have to have two things. One, you have to have somebody who's not being forthcoming about income that's coming in, whether it's net or gross income. And then second, you have to have that the person was actually ineligible. And so even if there was additional money that was coming in, after February of 2015, it's not established here that he was ineligible at that point. And again, we have the problem for the state is that the, you know, they didn't establish net income after that date. They would only establish, if anything, that there's some gross receipts still coming in from the business, but it's not clear how much of that was net income versus gross income, and it doesn't account for the expenses in this case.
So what is the state's obligation, if someone is not disclosing self-employment income? And I think that's an every 6 month disclosure requirement, right? I mean, is that when you, every 6 months it's reviewed, is that right? Or you have to?
Well, here, because he didn't disclose self-employment income, that they were, you know, you're providing for new benefits every 6 months.
Every 6 months, you're asking for new benefits. So
that's correct.
And were new benefits requested in January of 2015? There's a, or not?
I do know that there was 6 months prior to that, at least at the beginning of July of 2014, there was a request. I can't remember if there was a specific request in January. I know that there was some requests by the county. This is a really large case. There was a request by the county at some point for additional information, which he provided. I think at the appeals hearing that happens in March of 2015, you know, he provides information regarding his Orient account and in the Scott trade accounts, and so there is information provided, but I don't remember a specific exhibit from January of 2015.
Well, what I see, and maybe in our review of the record, is that on January 5th of 2015, he submitted another six-month report to renew benefits, reported $800 in annual income from selling used cars. Does that sound familiar?
That does sound familiar. Okay. I think there was some reference to a cell phone business that he had purchased at that point, but that hadn't yielded any net.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's there, but in any event, I guess my question is this. You're on, like, every 6 months you're asking for things.
Yep.
So let's say, and you're saying, let's just say that it was zero reported, but
yep.
800, whatever.
Yep.
And in fact, from July until January, you earned a lot in self-employment income, just not in every month. Some
yep.
months is a zero, the next month is 40, the next month is this. You know, where's the fraud? Is the state's obligation to go day by day, month by month? Like, what is it if overall, over that period of time, you in fact earned, on average, monthly, way over the qualification?
Well, the statute requires a finding that the person was ineligible during you know, the time period. And so let's say it's during that time period. But the state's experts testified that in order to determine self-employment, so to determine whether he was ineligible during that time period, it has to be done on a month-by-month basis. And so here, all the state's experts, unquestioned by anybody, testified that self-employment income, which would qualify this Orient business and the Scott trade accounts, have to be determined on a month-by-month basis. But then the state didn't bring in an expert to determine on a month-by-month basis whether Mr. Malik was ineligible any of the 29 months that are at issue here. And certainly there's not evidence, you know, during that last kind of time period that there's net income shown by Mr. Malik that would make him ineligible. So I think because the statute says the state has to prove that the person is ineligible, and the state's experts testify that for self-employment, which is the only employment that's being argued here, that it has to be determined on a month-by-month basis, we don't look at that entire six-month period. You look at it on a month-by-month basis, and it's the state's burden of proof to prove that he was ineligible during, you know, the January for sure, because that is an important month because they wait 3 years after that time before they charge him, but also to be able to show that he was ineligible during these time periods, calculate the amount that he received when he was ineligible, if they prove that, which we argue in the second issue they didn't, and then determine that it goes over the entire amount. I think here the state, instead of doing its job.
So if someone has self-employment income over a six-month period that in some months is zero and some months is, you know, a dollar above,
yeah.
Is it fraudulent for that person to take public assistance in a month where they're a dollar above, even though in the other months within that time period they're at zero, so that if you average it, you clearly qualify?
Yeah, I would agree with you that the state's witnesses, their experts, testified that if you were ineligible based on self-employment, it would be every single you. It would either be, you know, February you're ineligible, but January you weren't, based on how much net income came in during that month. And that was the state's obligation based on their experts to prove. It was not prove.
So it's an individual who receives income from self-employment or receives public assistance.
Yes.
Should, based on their filing at one point.
Yes.
It's sort of prospectively you get it then.
Yes. So if
they
let's say that Mr. Malik would have been forthcoming.
I'm sorry, just wait,
yeah,
wait
sorry,
one
I
second.
Apologize.
That's okay. Should they decline it in the months where they go a dollar over, even though, in a, you know, to avoid criminal prosecution, I'm wondering.
Yes. I think the only way you wouldn't have to worry about criminal prosecution by being over and receiving if you were forthcoming about the information. I think that's the problem here,
okay,
is that, you know, I think the state's case on one prong or one element of this crime is pretty convincing, that he wasn't forthcoming with the information. But then you do have that second prong of establishing ineligibility. So I think if we do have a situation where somebody's been forthcoming and they're found ineligible, they essentially would have to pay back the money that they received during that month in order. But here, because he wasn't forthcoming, the state charged, you know, this as a crime, but failed to prove the ineligibility, that he was ineligible during the time period, and specifically and importantly during January of 2015. The state has zero evidence, and there's nothing in their brief, there's nothing in the hundreds of documents I went over and exhibits I went over to prove that there's any net income in January of 2015 which would make him ineligible. I just want to, unless you have additional questions about either the first two issues, I'd like to move on to the third.
Go ahead.
And I apologize that this isn't in my brief, but actually the trial attorney here argues this statutory construction argument below. It's at in the July, I think, 16th pretrial hearing on page 3.
Is this the and issue?
Yes, the and issue. Makes this and issue argument and does a motion for essentially to dismiss the charges based on this, saying that the state isn't able to prove that he had the intent to defeat the purposes of all the statutes listed.
Do you agree that some of them don't even exist anymore?
I do agree with that.
So you've got to, if we interpret and to mean what you want it to mean, then that statute could never be charged.
Well, we talked about that in my moot yesterday. I think there probably are circumstances where somebody could declare their intent to defeat the purposes
of a non-existent
statute.
I don't know if your moot was right on that one.
No, I'm just saying the question came up. I'm not saying that the answer may still elude us.
In all seriousness, if we interpret the statute the way you want us to interpret it,
yep,
then the crime, for all practical purposes, no longer exists.
I think that is very possible. I also think that the statutory language is very specific here, and it's very clear, and means what it says based on the case law that's cited in the brief, and use of the purposes relates to all the statutes listed. I also don't think that, as the state argues in their brief, that you can piecemeal out subdivision 1 paren 1 and just say that stands on its own, because it is a reference to the main subdivision that's above. So this court and the Supreme Court at times have found that statutes, the way that they're written, can never be prosecuted because they violate the First Amendment, or they're void for vagueness, or there's other reasons. And so here, the way the legislature wrote this statute required a huge mens rea, an overarching mens rea that would be at least very hard to prove, and certainly was not proved here. And I think even if this court rewrote the statute and found that the mens rea requirement only applied to the purposes, to defeat the purposes of the two things charged here, the medical and the food stamps, the state also didn't, the jury isn't instructed that he has to intend to defeat the purposes of that. It's not clear what the purposes of that would be, but certainly there's no evidence presented that Mr. Malik intended to defeat the purposes. So he would, at the very least, even if this court rewrote the statute, found that it was somewhat vague and rewrote it and said it should apply for the medical assistance and food stamps because that's what's charged here. If you look at the policy statements in 256B01 or 256D01. I mean, the policy statements for those public assistance statutes aren't things that were covered in this trial. They're not things that were proven in this trial. And And so the evidence would be sufficient on that basis also. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Morgan Coons, and I am here for the respondent. Orient International was a business that bought and sold bulk lots of scrap metal. The owner of that business, Nadeem Malik, took draws from the business for personal use. He did this by transferring funds from the Orient International bank accounts into his personal bank accounts. When an owner of a business takes draws from the business account, he is deriving income from that business.
Was Orient a Schedule C business, or was it an LLC, or what was it?
It was incorporated as an LLC, but it had separate bank accounts that were totally controlled by Nadeem Malik. Okay. So had Nadeem Malik left all the money in the Orient International bank account and not spent it on personal uses, we would be looking at a very different situation.
But a draw by a sole proprietor or sole owner really can be a borrowing from the business against future earnings, correct?
It absolutely can be, Your Honor, and that's why in this case what the state presented at the trial was the net. How much did Nadeem Malik take out versus how much did he put in? And we also showed how he then spent that money. So you have both aspects of the case. You have both him taking the money and putting it into his personal account and then spending the money.
Is there evidence of those draws or that specific spending in January 2015?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that, Your Honor. There is. In Exhibit 38 and Exhibit 22. So Exhibit 38
is... again, 38 and 22?
Yep. Exhibit 38 is the summary exhibit that shows the funds being transferred in and out of the appellant's various accounts. That shows transfers in January of 2015. Exhibit 22, I believe, is the actual bank account for Orient International showing those transfers. There were indeed several draws. I would also point out Exhibit 12 are the Amex bank account records. That showed $1,500 in new charges in January of 2015. Exhibit 22 is Nadeem Malik's personal bank account. That shows over $5,000 of personal spending in January 2015. And Exhibit 24 is Nadeem Malik's wife's account, which shows over nearly $2,000 in spending in January 2015. So we have both, again, in January of 2015, we have money coming from the business to Nadeem Malik's personal accounts, and we have him spending that money.
So on the money coming from... I wish I had. Okay. Exhibit 38. Is that the? That's
Exhibit 38. It's the summary exhibit. That's going to show the inflow in and out of the two different accounts.
Okay, and it shows in January of 2015.
Yeah, I believe there are
like 1, 2, 3. It shows 5 entries, one of which is a withdrawal.
Correct.
So what are those entries tell us? Explain to me what they show us.
Well, they
relative to the amount required to qualify.
Absolutely. Okay. So they show us that in January 2015 he was taking money, and they also it's a net positive. So he took more in January 2015 than he put in.
So he took 14,000 out. I'm looking at the actual number. I just want to actually correlate it to the actual numbers I'm looking at.
That sounds high, Your Honor. I would have to go look at the exhibit myself to tell you. I think, is the 14,000 a negative?
That's a negative. Is that what he took out, or is that what he put in?
No, that's him putting money back into Orient International. And this is, I'm glad you raised this. This is part of the problem in this case, is there was extensive commingling of funds. And we went into this extensively at the trial. Nadeem Malik would take money from his personal equity account, put it into his business, take money from his business, put it into his credit cards, use his credit cards to pay off the personal equity account. So there's money flowing all over the place. But at the end of the day, what Exhibit 38 does is it nets out money coming from Orient International. So this is the business that he failed to disclose and that he totally controlled. And at the end of every yearly period, he took out much more than he put in.
So just focusing on 2015, just so I understand it, the entries that are in the positive, $1,600, $1,250, $3,500, that's Orient International account. Those represent the transfers into Orient International.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. The positive numbers are money coming out of the Orient International bank account, 0995, and going into his personal accounts.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
Yep. And, you know, I want to point out here, I also believe that the issue of January 2015 is a bit of a red herring. And the reason for that is the way that these benefits are calculated is on a six-month basis. And there's extensive testimony in the record about this. On 718, the 718 transcript on page 75 through 77, Dan Benefield talks about how SNAP decisions are made every 6 months. Aaron Gardner Cook, also on 719, talks about how they're approved for six-month periods. Bev Weika, another eligibility specialist with years of experience, including self-employment experience, explains that they take an average of income over a six-month period or over a yearly period to determine eligibility. And there's common sense reasons for this, and Your Honor was asking appellant about this before, but one could imagine a situation where someone runs a business and takes $150,000 in January and then is going to use that money for the rest of the year, but for February, March, April, the rest of the year, takes no income. That person would not be eligible for benefits because their yearly income was well above the income limits.
So in order to implement this, and with respect to the statute of limitations, you find the month, January 2015, which is the latest or earliest.
Well, I actually disagree.
And you go 6 months back, or how do we implement, how you figure out whether a statute of limitations is met?
So absolutely. So Nadeem Malik initially applied for benefits in August of 2012. And every 6 months following that, he has his benefits need to be reviewed. And so, in fact, he continued to receive benefits through July of 2016. So the statute of limitations would actually ran in July of 2019. And so when this case was filed in early 2018, we were well within the statute of limitations. Now, we made a decision, a prosecutorial decision, to focus on a narrower time frame. And there's some briefing below at the trial court that explains that prosecutorial decision, but that doesn't change the statute of limitations.
Well, but the only amounts that you presented in the exhibits were through the end of January of 15, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Again, that has to do with...
The record doesn't demonstrate ineligibility plus receipt of benefits after that month.
Well, there are some...
Prove those things.
Well, exactly, Your Honor. So we charged a much narrower time period. So we focused on a particular time period. It has to do, there's a lot of reasons that went into that, that comes down to prosecutorial discretion. The biggest reason has to do with it was February of 2015 when Nadeem Malik first disclosed the existence of Orient International.
So you might have been missing a different element at that point.
That's possible, Your Honor. That wasn't what the trial focused on. But for statute of limitations purposes, the statute begins to run when the benefits stop. And so that was in July of 2016.
At the end of exhibit number 38, that is the January 30th of 15 date, right?
Yes, that's correct. Yep.
Explain to me the significance, if any, of the negative $14,000 number during that month. Is that money he paid back to Orient?
Well, he was continuing to operate Orient International during that time frame. And so, yes, he took $14,000, I believe it was from his home equity line, and he put it into Orient International, and then he used it to buy scrap metal, which he later sold at a profit.
If I net out the numbers for January of 2015, I understand you don't agree that that's dispositive or even significant. But if I net those out, it looks like he put in well more than he took out during January.
According to Exhibit 38 there, that's absolutely right. Now, Exhibit 38 references the underlying bank record exhibit numbers.
Yeah, 31.
Yep. And so if you go to 31, if you go to, you know, Exhibit 22, the actual bank records, you see that following January of 2015, he continued to reap profits from Orient International. So money, that $14,000 he got back, but it was just in March, or it was in February or March, and it's not on that summary chart because the charge period focused on a much narrower time frame. Now, I think, you know, it is important to think about the statute of limitations piece, because when he submitted an application in July of 2014, he did not disclose his self-employment income. He did not disclose his operation of Orient International. And those statements got him benefits for a six-month period. And he received those benefits through January 31st of 2015. So the continuing violation language in the statute says that if a person makes a false statement to get benefits to which they're not entitled, the statute begins to run when they stop receiving those benefits. So just based on the false representations in July, the statute doesn't begin to run until the end of January. So So even under the more restrictive interpretation of the statute of limitations, when this case was filed on January 31st of 2018, we were within 3 years of January 31st, 2015. I just wanted to switch gears a little bit, Your Honor and Your Honors, and so in the appellant's brief, there was a lot of discussion, and we heard some discussion about it here at argument about net income. Now, the net profits or profitability of Orient International doesn't actually tell us much. So Orient International could have been a very profitable business, but if Nadeem Malik did not derive any income from that business, he would still have been eligible for benefits. So the question is not, did Orient International have overhead that was not deducted? The question is, how much money did Nadeem Malik take? And that's what Exhibit 38 does, is it shows the money going from Orient International into Nadeem Malik's business accounts, and that's what the credit card and bank accounts, the personal bank account statements show. It shows him taking the income derived from Orient International and spending it. So the focus is not on did Orient International have employees, did it have overhead. The focus is on how much did Nadeem Malik benefit from the business.
Well, if he had started the business, just in a hypothetical situation, a person puts $1 million into a business, and then it does some things. And then over the course of time, you take out money, but it's you're still operating within the original investment. Have you made any income for purposes of these programs?
Well, that's not what happened here.
I understand it's not what happened here in your view, but if you're just taking money in and out of your own pre-existing money, you don't have any income, right?
Right. If you're spending, well, actually, I believe there was testimony in the trial that spending down an asset, taking an asset and cashing it out and spending it does constitute income for purposes of eligibility. But again, that's just not what happened here. In this situation, Nadeem Malik was not investing, did not invest $100,000 and then spend that money down slowly. He was, you know, he would borrow $14,000 from his home equity line of credit. He would use it to buy scrap metal, and then he would sell that scrap metal for $18,000, and he would transfer that profit.
Okay, that actually gets to my question. Let's take that. He puts $14,000 in from his home equity line of credit. Until he takes more than 14 out, he hasn't really earned anything, right?
I think that's right, Your Honor. Yeah, I think that's right. And that's exactly what Exhibit 38 takes into account. And that's why you have to net out the positive money going out and the negative money coming in. It's that difference that's what's important. And the jury found here that that amount was over the limits. I only have a few seconds left, Your Honor, so I just wanted to touch briefly on the restitution issue. The respondent in this case failed to request a restitution hearing. I submitted a supplementary authority letter earlier this week, which cites a couple cases that talk about a failure to request a restitution within 30 days constitutes a waiver. So I just wanted to make sure that we put that on there. And then in my last 30 seconds, I just wanted to address the statutory interpretation issue. As Your Honor pointed out, if you interpret the statute the way appellant asks, the statute no longer exists. And I think a plain reading of the statute and the legislative intent behind it shows that the language of the purpose is to just explain that the purpose of public benefits is to provide people who are eligible with the assistance that they need. So with that, Your Honors, I appreciate your time, and I ask that you affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Axelson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you want to use that.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just quickly, respondent is wrong about the statute of limitations. If you look at the Shalaby opinion, which we cite in our brief, it says that the statute of limitations period does not begin to run until the wrongful conduct ceases. Here, in order to prove the crime, the state has to both show that he lied about something and he was ineligible. And I think after February of 2015, the state has found him eligible, the county found him eligible, that's what the evidence is. And at that point, he's provided a lot of this information. So it may not be able to meet either prong of the crime. And so certainly the statute of limitations period that the state charges here is not just on prosecutorial discretion, it's because they couldn't prove a crime after February of 2015. Additionally, the state really wants to just rely on money coming in and out, but the Mora decision from this court, it's unpublished, but it is pretty persuasive here, is that the state wants you to do their job that they didn't do at trial, and that's trying to prove net income here. And so the state says, well, money's coming in, money's coming out. We don't know what that money's for. We don't know what expenses were involved at previous times here. The state had experts that it could have had go through Mr. Malik's stuff over the 3 years it waited to charge him, and determine what counted as income, what counted as gross sales, what the expenses were, and then determine whether or not he was ineligible.
I must say, Mr. Eccleston, I'm looking at Mora, which is an unpublished decision, that just seems very different to me. I mean, small dollar amounts on a cocaine deal as opposed to so much money going in and out and, thousands of dollars as opposed to 100.
Well, it's different in that point. It's analogous in that this court said that it's the state's burden to prove net income, and that it's the state's burden to establish expenses, that the defendant doesn't have any burden in that respect. So I do agree it's less amounts of money, but the state chose to charge this crime, and by doing so, it takes the burden of beyond a reasonable doubt in establishing net income here. And the state simply doesn't do that. They want to talk about large amounts of money coming in and out. Somebody being bad with money, somebody overspending, somebody living extravagantly doesn't mean that they're rich or that they have a lot of income. Lots of people live and make bad decisions on how to spend their money and overspend on their credit cards. People lease cars that they can't afford. People get cell phones when they can't afford them. It doesn't mean that they're rich. And the state essentially wants to show that Mr. Malik had some expenses during January. Of course, people are going to have expenses. It doesn't mean that that qualifies as net income. And the other thing I want to point out is the statute requires him to be found ineligible. The state's witnesses testified that has to be done on a month-to-month basis. The fact that the county decides how they want to determine eligibility over a six-month period is not, at issue here. That it's what the statute says, and the person has to be found ineligible. But I think that there's a strong argument to be made, and we make it in the second issue, that by failing to establish expenses, by just relying on money that's coming in and out without linking that money to where it's coming from, and clearly he's getting money and loans from people too, to try to keep this thing afloat. But it's ultimately the state's burden to establish net income. It doesn't do so at all for the entire case. It doesn't do so on a month-to-month basis, as its state's experts said it had to do. And it allowed the statute of limitations time period to lapse here by waiting so long before it charged Mr. Malik with a crime. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We thank counsel for your briefing and argument. We'll issue our decision within 90 days. That brings us to our fourth and final oral argument for this morning, and that is Pesola versus Jaros. Am I pronouncing the names?
Jaros.
Jaros. And on this particular file, you are Mr. Rasmus?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. We have only a brief from the appellant. There is no brief from the respondent, and consequently, there will be no respondent's argument allowed under our rules. You will have 15 minutes for your oral presentation. Since the respondent is not making an argument, there will be nothing for you to rebut, and so it's just a 15-minute argument.
Understood.
Give us your name and the party you represent so that we've got that for the recording, and whenever you're ready, you may proceed.